For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'm your host, Red Sail, and today, Liz Fenwick transports us to the Cornish coast in her atmospheric new novel, The Path to the Sea.
As the weekend unfolds, secrets seem to be coming out of the woodwork, practically. And the question is, once you discover the secrets, what do you do with them?
Mark Billingham reveals how narrating his Tom Thorne detective thrillers has changed the way he writes them.
Now, that killer has a voice, which on the page is just words. But once I give that killer a voice, and then the killer is in plain sight for the rest of the book, I've got a problem.
And the doyenne of audio description, Di Langford, reflects on bringing plays, TV series and films to life for those of us who have difficulty seeing them.
If you're doing something like Braveheart, there's lots of horse battles, so you have to go over and over and over again picking out which is the most important person in that particular scene.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Liz Fenwick has been hailed as the queen of the contemporary Cornish novel. Her latest book, The Path to the Sea, witnesses three generations of women gather at the family home, a dramatic clifftop residence where they must confront the past and say farewell. It's a compelling, atmospheric read that's full of mystery.
Well, he's been like a father. Lottie winced. She knew how much the loss of his own father had meant to him, and how his grandmother had been grateful for Gramps' kindness and quiet guidance. Her question had been spiteful. Sorry. George mentioned that, when you last visited, there was a boyfriend in your life, and he may have said that he monopolized you. He took a step away. Did he? Alex nodded. So where is the boyfriend? As I mentioned, he isn't my boyfriend any more. She looked out to sea, suddenly thinking of Thailand. That will please George. She laughed. If he only knew.
Penny Herman-Smith narrating The Path to the Sea, which is TB704358. And the book's author, Liz Fenwick, joins me here in the studio. Liz Fenwick, welcome to Read On.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So I've been spending a very pleasurable week in Cornwall with The Path to the Sea. But for those who haven't yet read the book, can you introduce them to the plot?
I certainly can. It is the story of three generations of the Trewin women, all coming back to a cliffside house in Cornwall as the matriarch, the grandmother, is near her end. And as the weekend unfolds, secrets seem to be coming out of the woodwork, practically. And the question is, once you discover the secrets, what do you do with them?
It's a gripping story with a mystery at the heart of it. But the thing that unites the three generations of women who've had very different life experiences is their heritage, the beautiful clifftop house of Boscanna. Is that based on an actual place in Cornwall?
Oh, it is. It's probably based on my dream home. There was a film that came out a few years ago, Richard Curtis's film About Time. And when I saw that film, I fell in love with the house. I mean, it was an absolutely brilliant film. But the house captured my imagination. And when I'm trying to find stories, one of the key things for me is location and where it's set, because that kind of grounds the story and becomes a character almost of its own. And when I was researching, I will not say that I was searching the internet and killing time, I found a blog post on places that you could rent that had been used in films. And Porthpeen House was available. And that kind of went ping in my mind, because I'd had this vague idea of a story going around in the back of my mind. And that just kind of pulled it all together, because there was the setting I was missing. And then I went from there. But I also got to stay in the house.
there is a really strong sense of space, place and atmosphere. And as I say, it's the home or not home that unites the three women. Was there that equal sense of faded splendour to Porthcurn House when you were staying there?
The house is in very good nick for the most part, but it is a house right beside the sea. So you can tell by looking around those that have owned old houses that upkeep is a continuous battle. But unlike some holiday rentals that you go into, this one feels like a home. The edges have been knocked about a bit, and it shows its history, and it speaks to somebody like me. But I think any time you go into a place, you get an instant feeling about it. I've used other locations, and the feeling hasn't been anywhere near as warm or as welcoming.
Now, the grand matriarch of the family is Joan, who was a 1950s, 1960s wife and society hostess who is recalling the last great dinner party that she held and its rather unfortunate ending. She has a fascinating artifact that her granddaughter finds, a notebook that details all the dinner parties and the clothes and the menus that she had, which struck me as a fabulous artifact and presumably something that you'd read about or come across yourself.
I actually have my mother-in-law's. And she passed away 17 years ago. And as things are divided when people die, this notebook was handed to me by my sister-in-laws. And I really didn't give it much thought at the time. I did a quick open. I saw some recipes written down. I saw cuttings out of the Telegraph of recipes that caught her. But I didn't look at it in great detail. I came to our house, which is not far from where she was living in Cornwall, stuck it on the shelf and didn't really give it any more thought. And then about 5 years later, my critique partner, my writing buddy, Bridget Cody, was in the kitchen with me while I was cooking, and she started going through my cookbooks, came across this. She said, "Oh my God, this is fabulous. Have you really looked at it?" And she went through. And the 60s and 70s, my mother-in-law, bless her, had done exactly that, only occasionally noting her clothing down. But my father-in-law had been in advertising and she was giving 3 and 4 dinner parties a week. It was an extraordinary artifact. And Bridget looked at me and she said, "Oh, you need to write the Cornish Supper Club." And I thought, "Oh, I see what you're going with this, but no, it's not quite right." And then my husband walked in and he was reminiscing about these dinner parties. And he said, yeah, he remembered being a small child because he's the youngest of the lot in the kitchen with the woman that was helping his mother, looking through the serving hatch, waiting for his favourite foods to come back, the leftovers or uneaten bits. I suddenly thought, ooh, what if a child is witnessing a dinner party and sees something that changes their life forever, but they don't realise it? And that was kind of the seed. So that story has been banging around in my mind for quite a while, but it wasn't until I found the location that the whole thing pulled together and became the path to the sea.
And the child who witnesses something that she doesn't realise the significance of and actually records it in her diary is Diana, the daughter and the mother, the middle generation in the story, who has thrown herself into her work as a war correspondent and, well, I think you write, lives without love during the book.
I think Diana, she was a really interesting character to write in the sense that when I first put her on the page, I didn't like her at all because she keeps everything far away. She's got this wall that's impenetrable. She has been hurt several times, and in order to exist, she just keeps everything at a distance. And by the time I'd finished the book, she became my favourite character. And what's fascinating for me about it was looking at Diana as a 64-year-old woman and then looking at her as an 8-year-old child and seeing the transition from lively, loving, warm, open to completely closed and shut off.
Yeah, she does come across as a more and more sympathetic character the better you get to know her younger self.
Yes, absolutely. As I say, in the end, she has come across as my favourite character in the book. But I think that took a while because when she was first on the page, I was like, ooh, I won't say the word I thought she was. And it took a while to get under her skin and to figure out what was really motivating her to behave in the way she did.
And her daughter, Lottie, who though the youngest, actually is in some ways the most mature, I felt, in the book, has come back from London after disastrous occurrences and wrong decisions, and is adrift, but a strangely sane voice of reason in a otherwise rather repressed household.
I think the thing is with Lottie is she understands love better than the other women do. Each of the other two have acted out of love in some way or other, but it hasn't necessarily been the warmest or most sensible way. Lottie is 28. She still hasn't closed many doors, and she has had loving relationships which the other two women really haven't had. I say that knowing that Joan has a loving relationship with her second husband, but Lottie has had the love of her grandmother, the love of her grandfather. She had a first boyfriend that was a tremendous love that, you know, she messed up. That sort of thing. But when you're 18, you mess that up a lot.
Certainly in Joan's case, and to a lesser extent in Diana's case, there is a real sense of duty standing in the way of freedom of decision. And maybe that's something that has changed through the generations. Back in the 1960s, it was a more patriarchal society. A woman had her place in that society and wasn't really meant to move out of it. And in Diana's case, to be the successful war correspondent, she had to bury her softer side to be taken seriously, whereas Lottie has more choice.
She certainly does. Looking at the two time periods, 1962 and the current day, and doing a little bit, just scratching the surface of research, it kind of shocks you to find out that as soon as Joan married, she could no longer work. That wasn't allowed. And you look back and you say, oh, how? Why? And those changes still exist. And then I think of myself. I'm 10 years younger than Diana. And the generation before me coming through, trying to break that glass ceiling, made it easier for me to come through. And I watch my own daughter moving through the system now and not seeing it. So Lottie is benefiting from all the changes that have taken place, thankfully, due to women pushing against that. So it was kind of fun to look at that progression along the way.
There's so much to talk about in this book. There's a love story, there's espionage, there's a potential murder mystery, and it's written in three timelines. I was wondering, did you write each timeline separately, or did you actually write the chapters alternately? So Joan, Diana, Lottie, and then come back and start Joan, Diana, Lottie as you progressed through the day?
No, I've learned my lesson on that one, particularly when I'm doing a historical thread, because that will normally dictate what needs to be revealed in the current day. So I wrote Joan's story first. I didn't, when I did my first draft, Diana as an 8-year-old was only in diary form. We didn't see her actively on the page. But it was at the end of the first draft that I realized we needed to see her more fully and for her to come alive, to see the transition of the older Diana. From then, I made a cross for my own back in the sense that setting the book in one weekend, be it 1962 or 2018, but the timelines aligned, and I took that as a sign because it was both Friday, the 3rd of August, and I thought, oh, well, I've got to do this. But to tell basically three life stories over a 4-day period presented myself with quite a challenge. But I think sometimes when you put yourself in a box as a writer, it forces you to be more concise and to really use the space that you have. So once I had Joan's story and I had the diary entries for Diana, I then went and wrote Diana and Lottie, intermixing Joan's story. So sort of looking at the time clock, because each chapter is written in the course of the day. So you never go backwards in time. You're always moving forward through the weekend. So it was an interesting challenge.
Well, it certainly keeps you turning the pages. Now, we've already mentioned Cornwall, clearly a great inspiration for not just this story, but your writing in general. What is it about Cornwall? The rugged coastline, the craggy men? It's timeless.
It is timeless, and it's the landscape. There's no question about it for me. The landscape speaks to me. It makes me sound completely and utterly insane, but I see stories in the landscape. And I've tried to explain it that my roots are genetically, as it turns out, I'm totally Irish. And when I went to Ireland for the first time when I was 13, and I just felt my roots literally go into the soil, I was completely at home. And I came to Cornwall and I wanted that connection. But of course, my roots don't go down at all. And the only way that I could hold on to Cornwall and make it mine was to write about it.
There's been quite an explosion in Cornish literature over the,
yes.
Well, the Poldark effect, I suppose.
It was coming for a while. Mm. I was kind of at the forefront of it. Then the Poldark new series came out. And slowly but surely, people have realised that people want to read about Cornwall.
But there's a rich heritage going back to Daphne du Maurier and Virginia Woolf as well.
Yes, absolutely. And Rosamund Pilcher. There are many.
Are you a fan of du Maurier, or do you try not to read too much of her in case it bleeds into your own writing?
I absolutely adore her work. I don't think anybody does, quotation marks around that, Cornwall the way she does. Her evocation of the landscape is what I would love to achieve. What I could never do, which she does, is she really explores the darker side of things. And that is not me. Ultimately, I'm too much on the light side of things for that. But when I was trying to find my voice as a writer, I realized that I was sort of trying to take her and combine her with somebody like Jodi Picoult or Cornwall with issues. I wanted Cornwall with a page-turning quality to it, not that either of them on their own aren't page-turning and so forth. But in the end, that's not quite where I've landed, but it's made me find out what the unique Liz Fenwick voice is.
And are you working on another novel?
Of course I am. Can't tell you the title yet because it hasn't been agreed, but controversially, it will be set on the banks of the Tamar, so it will have Cornwall as well as Devon in it.
Well, maybe you can help unite those two sibling counties.
Well, we could get into a discussion of jam first on our scones, but
more than my job is worth.
Yes.
You must be delighted that your books have been made into such great audiobooks. Do you have anything to do with the selection of the narrators?
Sadly, no, but I've always been delighted by them. People come back to me. A lot of people listen to audiobooks and they're on the rise. And somebody in our village who is a seamstress listens to audiobooks, and she listened to one of my books. And unfortunately, nobody had ever asked me how something was pronounced. And it was a local place name. And that name was mentioned 147 times in the book. And it did ring a little bit wrong to anybody who knew the locality. So I listened to the book myself, because it's very hard to listen to somebody else performing your book in a way. And by the end of it, it was a course of two drives up and down to Cornwall. My husband and I were parked in London in the car listening to the last pages, and I was weeping buckets. So my feeling was that, my God, she really and truly got to the heart of this book that I, who know the story so well, sitting there in pieces.
Do you have any links to sight loss yourself?
I do. My mother has macular degeneration and is now at the point of needing to listen to audiobooks. My middle son has a birth defect, so he has vision really only in one eye. And I remember fondly my great aunt, who lost her sight in her later years, listening to books on tape, as it was then.
So you must be delighted that you're reaching an audience that is otherwise print disabled.
Absolutely. And I should say that audiobooks were essential with my eldest child, who had severe dyslexia. And the only way that he could hear stories that were age appropriate, as opposed to the Kip and whatever they were books that he was capable of reading, he could listen to stories that satisfied that need that we all have for stories. So I can't say enough.
Well, Liz Fenwick, thank you so much for coming all the way up from Cornwall to share some more insights into The Path to the Sea with the Read On listeners. And my only regret is that I am not going to be able to take it on holiday with me because I've already finished it. I hope you'll come back at the end of the show to share the books of your life.
Absolutely.
The Path to the Sea is out now and is available from the RNIB Library as TB704358. It's narrated by Penny Herman-Smith. And Liz Fenwick will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Di Langford discusses how her work in audio description differs to being a talking book's narrator. But first, my summer holiday wouldn't feel complete without a good crime thriller to immerse myself in. And one of my favourite detectives is Tom Thorne. An added bonus is that his creator, Mark Billingham, not only writes but narrates the series. I caught up with him between recording sessions at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. Mark Billingham, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
So you're in the Talking Book Studios recording The Killing Habit, the latest Tom Thorne book. Can you give us a little bit of a teaser? Let us know what's in it.
Well, the previous book, a book called Love Like Blood, which I also did the audio recording for, was inspired by a real case, which is not something I've done before, and I didn't think I would ever do it again, at least not quite so quickly. But this new book, The Killing Habit, is directly inspired, not actually inspired, based on not just a real case, but a real case that is ongoing and as yet unsolved, which is a perpetrator known as the UK Cat Killer. He was called the Croydon Cat Killer when he started, and then the M25 Cat Killer, but he now seems to have expanded his area of operations, shall we say, to the point where he's being called the UK Cat Killer. This is somebody who's killed at least 450 animals, mostly pet cats, also foxes, squirrels, whatever takes his fancy, presuming it's a he. And, of course, one of the things that the police are very keen on is, well, they're keen on catching this person largely because of the worry that he may move on to something else, because, of course, killing animals is one of the things that nascent serial killers are widely thought to do. So I thought this would be an interesting case to write about. I then got an in on the case through a contact with a retired officer who'd worked very closely on the operation. So I was able to talk to him. He gave me at least one outlandish theory that they're exploring, which I'm not going to reveal because it's in the book. And so, The Killing Habit is the, whatever, his 14th or 15th Tom Thorne novel. I can't remember.
I think it's 15.
Yeah,
I think
like
I've listened to each and every one as a talking or audio book.
You are a sucker for punishment.
Oh, and you do produce one a year.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, it's an amazing work rate because you're also doing your film work and your comedy work as well, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I mean, I do other stuff, but I don't think a book a year is a hardship. I need to qualify that, which is that I'm one of the very lucky writers who writes full-time, you know, because I think something like 95% of published writers don't write full-time. They still have proper jobs. But because I write full-time, I've got kind of no excuse. I've got nothing else to do. I mean, yeah, I'm doing, you know, I play in this band and I do sort of comedy stuff and bits and bobs, but I can do my 1,000 words a day, and if you do that, a book a year is very achievable.
And you clearly enjoy spending time with Tom Thorne, and you share a lot of things with him. Birthday, love of country music.
Oh, yes.
I mean, Agatha Christie famously wanted to kill off Poirot with every book that she wrote. Do you find living with Tom Thorne a bit like living with your brother? Or
I know what you mean. I mean, I do take a break from him every so often to write a standalone novel. And I think that's the way to do it, to keep yourself, well, you know, A, sane, and B, sort of interested in the character. Because the problem with a series character is the law of diminished returns. And we all know of series that are, shall we say, past their sell-by date, go on too long. You don't want to be that writer that writes one book or three or four books too many. And you love to think there's a voice in your head that will tell you when it's time to stop, but there may not be. So the way to do it is to step away every so often, do something else. You know, I do these other things that are collaborative, which is really good because obviously writing is an incredibly solitary thing. So to go off and work with another with four or five other crime writers in this band, or two or three musicians here and there, or whatever it is, gives me a break from that stuff.
I've got to ask you about the band. I was going to save it till last.
But okay.
The fun-loving crime writers.
Yes.
Tell us more.
Well, it was an accident. It started. There's a thing called the World Mystery Convention, which happens every year in a different American city. And a couple of years ago, it was in New Orleans. We were all having a great time. And on the last night, there was a gig in the House of Blues, incredibly famous venue in New Orleans. And the idea was that there was going to be this band, and then various people could get up and do a bit, various of the attendees at the conference. So me and another couple of writers, an Irish writer called Stuart Neville and a Scottish writer called Doug Johnson, said, oh, let's get up and do a bit. We'll, you know, have a little show off. But the gig went very badly, and it wasn't quite what people thought, and people started to leave, and it all went a bit wrong. And then the lead singer of this band, as she was leaving the stage, went, where are the Brits? I hear there are some Brits here. So Stuart, Doug and I, together with a local drummer, shambled onto the stage and just busked our way through three songs, which I can still remember. They were Werewolves of London by Warren Zevon, Folsom Prison Blues by Johnny Cash, and oddly, 500 Miles by The Proclaimers. And we just shambled our way through these songs. Anyway, and it went incredibly well. I mean, largely because of what we were following, I think. But it did go very well. And somebody put it on YouTube. And the next thing, we were getting contacted by the Edinburgh International Book Festival saying, right, I'm booking you lot for an hour and a half in August. And we went, what? I mean, A, we've only got three songs, an hour and a half. And also, we're not a band. There's just three of us. So we put a band together. We knew a lot of crime writers who were musically gifted, who'd been in bands and stuff. So we recruited Val McDermid to come in, and Chris Brookmeyer, and Luca Veste, Liverpool writer, who's a brilliant bass player. And suddenly we had this band. We had a couple of days rehearsal, and we were off. And because at least three of the band, and I'm not one of them, are really, really proper musicians, the band is pretty good. You know, we're always a lot better than people expect when they think, oh, it's just those crime writers messing about. And, you know, we're a pretty tight band. And we do lots of cover versions. They're all about murder. You know, they're all about crime and murder, police, detectives. And we've been just playing a lot. And we've got a big run of shows coming up between now and the end of the year. We get booked at festivals, you know, so on the final night of a festival, after everybody's been listening to stories about violence and crime fiction or what noir is or whatever it is, they just let their hair down and we rock and roll like a bunch of old people we are.
And do you sing as well as play the guitar?
I sing and play the guitar. So, I mean, actually everybody in the band sings, and we play for, you know, hour and 20 minutes with an interval because we need to lie down after 40 minutes. And it's just tremendous fun. But one of the things that makes it so enjoyable, we're all mates, we all get on, but it is that collaborative thing. Suddenly it's not just about you, and you can just have fun with four or five other people. And yeah, we are. It's so much fun that actually going back to writing the books is quite hard after we've done a few shows.
Now, Tom Thorne loves his country music, and it sounds as if that actually allows you to build your record collection. But I understand you're also a very, very keen collector of crime novels yourself.
Well, yes, and that's kind of how the whole thing started, was that I've got that collecting gene, I think. And so I used to collect first edition crime fiction. I mean, I was crazy about it. The American first, the British first, the proof, the whatever. And eventually my wife said, you've got to find some way to start getting these books for free. You know, they're taking over the house. It's using up all our money. So I started reviewing crime fiction, which means, you know, you start to get the books for free. And I became sort of just hanging around on the fringes of that community and getting to know everybody. And then once the final piece of the puzzle fell into place, which was actually writing one, suddenly I was a member of that community. It's a very odd thing. I mean, I remember going to interview big, huge writers, people like Michael Connelly and Ian Rankin, the writers who are now close mates. But, you know, I remember sitting there nervously with a tape recorder interviewing them, you know, 20-odd years ago.
And do you feel that was a kind of apprenticeship? Were you looking for hints and ins to a world that you clearly absolutely love?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I was certainly attracted. I mean, I write crime fiction because I read it. You know, I've always been a fan of it. But having met a lot of people, the writers, met some editors and agents and people around it, I realised what a nice kind of world it would be to join. I mean, you know, it's a bit of a cliche, but crime writers are generally a very collegiate and clubbable bunch, and we're hugely welcoming. We're hugely welcoming. It's odd. I mean, you know, I've now been doing it the best part of 20 years, but I still feel like a kind of new boy. It's odd. I like to keep imagining I'm a young buck, which is really rather tragic.
Having been to a couple of Crime Writers Association meetings, I've actually found that there's no arrogance assuming that you know everything already. Everybody is looking to swap anecdotes, to learn a bit more. I learnt an awful lot about forensic science by just a free meeting that I was invited along to. It's almost like you're all at college.
Yeah, and people do pass stuff on. I mean, oddly, we don't tend to talk about work that much. You know, get any bunch of crime writers in a room, they're much more likely to talk about music or sport or whatever. Maybe that's all writers do that. Maybe it's a sort of superstitious thing. You don't go, well, how's the new book going or whatever. But writers will share knowledge. I mean, within the Crime Writers Association, there is a kind of handbook which will reference which writers are experts about which subject. So if you want to find out about firearms, you call this guy. If you want to find out about poisons, which actually I do for the book I'm currently writing, you will talk to that person. So there is this kind of pool of knowledge about everything from, you know, forensics to committing the perfect murder.
How did you get into narrating your own book?
Well, that's an odd one. I mean, it was something that was mentioned way back at the beginning because I have a performance background and I used to be an actor. It was sort of vaguely suggested, but I realised even then what a very hard thing it was to do and not something I could just go, oh, yeah, I can knock that off. So I didn't for a long time. And eventually, the book started to be narrated by a wonderful actor called Robert Glenister. And Robert just did a fantastic job on them. And then there was a TV adaptation. And the TV adaptation starred David Morrissey as Tom Thorne, who was absolutely brilliant. And of course, you know, with one eye on commercial aspect of it and so on, the publisher said, let's ask David Morrissey to start narrating the Thorne books. And David said, yes, great. And we were all set and it was studio booked and everything. And then David got a movie or something and suddenly couldn't do the narration. So, of course, desperately, they went back to Robert. By that time, Robert had got a movie or something and he couldn't do it either. And I remember getting a phone call. How do you fancy having a go? And so I went in and that's it. I've done them ever since. And I thoroughly enjoy it. I always say to people after I've done it, it's always so much more exhausting than you think it's going to be, which sounds kind of odd because you're just reading. But for 3 days solidly reading incredibly slowly, the kind of mental effort of that and the effort of trying not to trip over your words to delineate different characters. You know, I should have learned by now because I know I'm going to narrate these books. But then I'll get in the studio and I'll go, why have I written a scene that's got four different Polish women in it? Or lots of people with very strong North Wales accents, which are incredibly hard. Or, you know, sometimes I just make a rod for my own back. But I do thoroughly enjoy doing it. And one of the things I do, and I don't know whether I don't think I'm unique in this, but I think it's something more people should do, is that I don't just record the audio book. I record an audio version of the book in that I will rewrite the book for audio because there are things that work in the book that simply won't work as a listening experience. You know, crime writers use this trick all the time. For example, when you're inside a killer's head, let's say, in the first person. Now, that killer has a voice, which on the page is just words. But once I give that killer a voice, and then the killer is in plain sight for the rest of the book, I've got a problem. So I will rewrite those scenes and change them from first person to third person, or take things out or put things in. There's always a little bit of rewriting that needs done, but I want people, when they read the book, to have the best time possible, and I want the people who are listening to the book to have the best time possible. So, yeah, I will make adjustments.
Yes, it can be a huge spoiler when you get the voice of the killer
on
page 10 and you just go, oh.
That's Brian from the... Yeah, that's Brian who was working in the shop. And you can't cheat. I mean, There's no point cheating and changing his voice because why would he do that?
Well, that's right. He can't be a Geordie when you're inside his head and actually turn out to be Welsh.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm. And it's only when... I don't think about it as I'm writing. I just try to write the best book I can. But then the audio publisher will read the book and go, ah, we do have a problem with chapters 12, 48. And so I will rewrite them.
And are you a fan of audiobooks yourself, or are you still very much a print man?
No, I listen to audiobooks in the car. I tend to listen to music if I'm on a train or on the tube, but on a long car journey, an audiobook is a wonderful thing. I listen to more non-fiction than fiction, and it's incredible the way a five-hour journey can just suddenly, you go, what? How did I get here? I don't remember taking the turn off from the motorway. It's kind of worrying that you lose yourself in the book so much as you're listening. And I do think it goes back to this thing where we forget how wonderful it is to be told a story. I did a show last year that was me on stage with a couple of musicians who were doing songs, but essentially I was telling a story for half an hour. And the show lasted an hour because they were playing songs, but it was just me telling the audience a story. And people came up afterwards and said, it's so great to be told the story again, because you just, that doesn't happen once you grow up. And I think we forget what a nice experience that is.
Well, I am very much looking forward to you telling me the story of The Killing Habit, which is out in a couple of weeks.
June the 14th, I believe.
Mark Billingham, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you.
Now, for the first time anywhere, and exclusive to RNIB Connect Radio, here's a sneak preview of The Killing Habit, written and narrated by Mark Billingham.
The party was in full swing, the cash and carry booze flowing freely, and the buffet his wife had slaved over taking a hammering, when Andrew Evans spotted the Duchess and thought for a second or two that he was going to shit himself. That, or throw up on the spot. He was in the garden, watching the sun he hadn't seen in 18 months creep carefully down a plastic slide when he caught sight of her. She was standing at the open back door with a serviette in one hand and a drink in the other. She smiled and stood aside to let a teenage boy pass, then turned to look at Evans. She waved and raised the paper cup she was holding.
It's going pretty well, isn't it?
Evans' wife helped their son up from the bottom of the slide and shook her head as the boy immediately ran around for another go.
Good turnout.
Yeah. Lucky with the weather. She looked at him.
You all right? Yeah, I'm fine, Evan said. Why wouldn't I be?
He reached across to stroke her bare arm, then downed what was left of his beer and crushed the empty can in his fist. Just going inside to get another drink. The welcome home banner that had been strung across the small patio had begun to droop a little, and he was forced to duck beneath it on his way towards the back door. The old woman in the doorway stood aside for him, and he walked past without acknowledging her. In the kitchen, he grabbed the beer that he now very much needed and hugged his sister, who had clearly needed several already. Collared on his way back out by a couple of people he used to work with, he thanked them for coming, told them it meant a lot, and said he would catch up with them properly later. Then, though it was the last thing he wanted to do, Evans walked back outside, laying a hand on the old woman's mottled, fleshy arm as he passed, to let her know that she should follow him.
Mark Billingham's latest Tom Thorne thriller, Fair Little Secret, is out now in hardback, ebook, and audio from wherever you buy your books. And a wide selection of Mark's other books is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. For more information, go to the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Liz Fenwick to hear the books of her life, Di Langford is the doyen of audio description. She's been enhancing TV shows, film, theatre and opera for visually impaired audience members since AD first started. And it all began because she was an RNIB Talking Books narrator, a job she still loves doing, as I found out when she joined me in the studio. Di Langford, welcome to Read On.
A pleasure.
So I was looking through the list of books that you've recorded for the RNIB Talking Books Library, and it's enormous. It's 115, I think, at most recent count.
I think I've lost count by now.
How did you start?
Well, a friend who'd come for an audition once, he's South African, and he'd come and they wanted someone who could do all those sort of clicky accents. And after he'd done the audition, he rang me up and he said, hey, by the way, they need somebody who can do Welsh, so could you just get in touch with them? So I came along, and the first book I was asked to read, it was called The Women of Llangollen. And it actually turned out to be two Irish women who'd moved to Llangollen. Now, I don't speak Welsh. I was born in Cardiff, but I can pronounce the names of towns, which is all I really had to do in that book. And I think that is the only Welsh book I've ever read in all those years.
But you seem to have covered the globe. I noticed you've done an awful lot of books about China, including a biography of Chairman Mao.
Well, I think that was about 19 hours recorded listening. I mean, it took us longer than that to obviously record it, but to listen to it, it would take you 19 hours. That was hard going because he was a monster. And the reason I think I got involved with Chinese books is because I was quite good at reading phonetics, sight reading them. And when we first started doing books here, somebody who knew about languages would go through the books in advance, check out anything they thought needed pronunciation, and then write it out in phonetics, which I happened to do at drama school. Nowadays, we have to do that ourselves, but initially someone else would do that for us. And then once I'd had one Chinese one and it seemed okay, I kept getting more, which was fine.
Well, one of my favourites, the book I thoroughly enjoyed, is called All the Tea in China, all about a Scotsman, a botanist who was sent over to, well, steal tea plants to transport them to India.
Yes, that's extraordinary, isn't it? I read that book and it's amazing how that happened, that we think we know all about it and there are all these stories behind that nobody knows anything about.
For 2 weeks, he had been confined on a listless junk near the city of Fuzhou, at the mouth of the Min River. His ordinarily robust constitution was near collapse. With a raging fever, he took to his bunk in the cabin of a seagoing cargo boat, dizzy from the smell of bilge water and rotting fish. The junk's deck was laden with timber from the countryside. Also on deck was Fortune's cargo, which included trunk-sized glass boxes filled with flowers, shrubs, grasses, vegetables, fruits, and all manner of exotic plant life. These glazed cases, known as Wardian or Ward's cases after their inventor, were on their way with Fortune to London, if he ever made it that far. with his long legs dangling off a bunk made for shorter Chinese men. Fortune, only 33 years old at the time, imagined himself dying in the boat's hold, being swaddled in his grimy bedclothes, then unceremoniously hurled overboard. A watery grave in China would be the end of him.
My guest, Di Langford, reading All the Tea in China. So you haven't only read biographies and histories. There's a huge number of classic crime books, such as those by Ellis Peters, to your name, and quite a lot of historical romances. Do you have a favourite genre that you enjoy reading?
No, not particularly. I really enjoy reading them all because they're books that I would never read myself, probably. Lots of romantic sagas, family sagas, a lot of them set in South Wales, which is, of course, where I come from. So those are interesting, but I don't have a particular favourite at all.
You've done a lot of children's books as well, including all the Mallory Towers books, which
yes,
I know my daughters thoroughly enjoyed.
Those were fun.
And Carrie's War.
Yes.
Now, I noticed that you've actually done three or four of Nina Borden's books, including a rather moving tribute to her husband who was killed in the Potter's Bar train crash.
Yes, yes, that's right. That was very moving.
Do you have a particular affinity with her writing? Is that why you've been asked to do so many of her books?
I don't know. I'm not quite sure how each particular reader is chosen. I think Rupert will ring up or pass your name on to someone, to whoever it is who's doling out the books. I'm not quite sure how that works.
And how do you go about preparing to narrate a talking book?
Well, I read it, and as I'm going through, I make a note, particularly there's a lot of dialogue, of who's speaking. So I just put an initial. So if it's Norman, I'll just put N next to it. And if it's Mary, I'll put M next to that bit of dialogue, so that you can sort of sight read it as you go. And that's it, really. Just getting familiar with the characters, not acting it out, using perhaps a slightly deeper voice for a man or a lighter voice for a woman. Obviously, if you know that someone is Welsh or perhaps Scottish, you won't overdo that, but make an attempt at those accents.
And will you read the book once or twice?
Yes, definitely. And if it's a very complicated one, then more than once.
And, of course, your work as an audiobook narrator has fed directly into another career as an audio describer for stage, TV and film.
Yes, yes, that's right.
How did that come about?
Well, the RNIB began by deciding that they were going to describe films. And what would happen there would be that the description would be recorded onto the soundtrack of the film, which would then be available on VHS, which could be borrowed or rented from the RNIB or could be bought from the RNIB. The RNIB asked some of the talking book readers to audition to be audio describers, and four of us were chosen to do it. And we started off, and really, we made it up as we went along because nothing had been done like that before. And so we just did what we could, and it grew and it grew and it grew. And now most of the big film companies are including audio description on their DVDs, but when we were doing it, it was only done on VHS.
That indicates that it was sometime back in the 1990s then?
It was a long time ago, yes, it was.
And do you remember the first films or series that you worked on?
I do remember the very first book that I narrated was written by one of the other describers. And we were so keen to get it right that I actually went to his house and we rehearsed it before we got into the studio. And in those days, when we were actually doing the descriptions, we worked in recording studios in Soho, which were provided for us by the film companies.
And how many times would you watch a film or a play before you would set down the script that you're going to audio describe it from?
When it was a film, you'd have it on DVD or VHS when we began, but now on DVD. And so you just play it backwards and forwards, depending. If you're doing something like Braveheart, there's lots of horse battles. So you have to go over and over and over again, picking out which is the most important person in that particular scene. With a play, we'll go to see it once, and then we'll be provided with a DVD of the actual performance, which we can then work on at home. And again, depending on the action, That will depend on how often you look at it. If there are dances, for instance, you keep having to go backwards and forwards, working out the dance routine. Whereas if it's mainly dialogue, just people coming in and out of a room or maybe even sitting down, just those very simple actions, that doesn't take as long to do. It's the physical stuff, lots of fighting or battles in a film, or dance routines particularly take quite a long time.
I often wonder how you fit quite so much information into 4 or 5 words, because you've got a necessarily very small window of opportunity. And do you find yourself crafting the same short sentences again and again to cut down the number of syllables?
Yes, the description part is easy. The hard part is cutting it down to fit into the space available, because we don't talk over dialogue. Or if you're doing opera, for instance, we don't talk over significant music or any sort of mood sounds. So, yeah, definitely.
Now, one of your first jobs was working on the Harry Potter films.
Yes, that's right.
And you audio described all of them?
I did.
And I believe that for some time, the audio descriptions of the first three weren't actually available with the DVD box set.
With the box set, apparently, that's what happened. Since then, I get some idea that they are now available. I'm still trying to find out, because I would like to get a box set of all of them. At the moment, I've got 5 of them on DVD with my voice on, and the first three are still on VHS. I still have a VHS player. I haven't tried playing them recently, but I'm assuming it's there. But I just thought it would be lovely for my grandchildren to have that box set with my voice on all of them. So I'm pretty certain it's now available, but I'll probably need to get onto Warner Brothers and find out which edition it is.
That gives your grandchildren great bragging rights in the playground, doesn't it? My granny described all of the Harry Potter films.
It definitely does. And interestingly, now when I sometimes do plays, and we have a touch tour beforehand so that people can come on stage and walk around the set, feel the costumes, maybe meet the actors, every so often will somebody say, "Excuse me, I think I recognise your voice." And it's because they've listened to me, perhaps as a child. Now, 20 years ago was when we first started to do them.
It strikes me that it's probably a very different discipline to be an audio describer to being a talking book narrator, because presumably you have to watch the film or the programme and then write yourself a script as to what you're going to describe.
Yes, that's right. So the film company would provide us with a script which had a time code on it, which would be the cue. We could use that for setting ourselves cues for when we were going to include our description.
Do you have a motto to remind yourself of how to do the best job as an audio describer? Is there a secret?
A motto? Oh. I suppose telling the story is a good one, because often there are so many things when you're looking at a screen and there are lots and lots of things going on, and you've got to decide, prioritise what's important in this scene and what is going to help the person who's not able to actually see it understand what's happening. Where are the important places? If I'm focusing as a viewer, how can I help my listener to also focus on the action happening on the screen?
I was wondering, do you ever close your eyes and watch the film with your ears and then think, oh, what's that sound? I need to describe that.
I used to do that. When we first started, that was something that we did do. I don't do it as much now, but every so often that will happen. If there's something happening, there's a lot going on, if you do listen, you can hear particular sounds. And what I've also become aware of, when I've perhaps sat with someone who is sighted and is listening to an audio description, afterwards they might say, well, that wasn't in any way intrusive, and it actually made me aware of things I would never have noticed before.
I think the best audio description is very inobtrusive and actually rather minimalist. I think if there's too much audio description, sometimes I don't focus on what's happening. I'm just trying to gather everything around it.
Yes.
It's a bit of a muddle.
That's right.
Do you find that you have to use a different voice as an audio describer to that of a narrator, that it can't be as expressive, maybe?
It depends. I think, for instance, if you're doing a film, I don't do films as much now, I do plays, but certainly when we were doing films, that if you had a battle scene, your voice is obviously going to have more energy in it than if you were doing a romantic love scene. So I think, yes, that you would go with the mood, really, of the scene without over-dramatising, because a lot of audio describers have been actors, or still are actors, in fact. And so you have to be careful that you don't want to be one of the performers in the production. You've got to remember that you're not a performer. You're a voice in someone's ear who's just helping them make sense of what's going on.
Yes, you're enhancing the performance rather than leading the audience member through it.
Yes, yes, that's a good way of putting it.
So, if I could offer you any film or stage play to audio describe, which one would you push all the other AD narrators out of the way for?
Wow, it's hard to say, because everyone I do is different. For instance, I'm doing, at the moment, plays, not films. And so I'm doing the Harry Potter plays in the West End. I'm doing Fiddler on the Roof. I've just done a play at the Bush, which is in a very small space, much more intimate there. So each one is an adventure. So I'm not going to choose one. I'm just going to enjoy them all.
How about a book to be a talking book narrator of then?
Again, this is exactly the same. I really, really enjoy every book that I read. It's a pleasure to do them. I really enjoy them.
Well, there you go. Not talking yourself out of any future work. I think that's a very diplomatic answer. Di Langford, thank you so much for being the voice in my ears for so many wonderful books and making my enjoyment of TV and film as a blind person far greater over the last few years.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
For a full list of the scores of books that Di Langford has narrated for the RNIB Library, visit the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. Now it's back to Liz Fenwick for the books of her life. So, Liz, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I fell in love with The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. I don't know how many times I read that book. I just wanted to live in that world, have those adventures. And I don't know, it just captured me in a way that very few books have captured me along the way. I can't say it made me want to be a writer, but it made me want to live in that world, which I think is one of the key things, because it would continue on in my mind.
Tom! No answer. What's gone with that boy, I wonder? You, Tom! No answer. The old lady pulled her spectacles down and looked over them about the room. Then she put them up and looked out under them. She seldom or never looked through them for so small a thing as a boy. They were her state pair, the pride of her heart, and were built for style, not service. She could have seen through a pair of stove lids just as well. She looked perplexed for a moment and then said, not fiercely, but still loud enough for the furniture to hear, "Well, I lay, if I get hold of you, I'll—" She did not finish, for by this time she was bending down and punching under the bed with the broom, and so she needed breath to punctuate the punches with. She resurrected nothing but the cat. I never did see the beat of that boy.
The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, written by Mark Twain, is available in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB15556. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, there's a book that I'm waiting to reread, and that is The Year of Marvelous Ways by Sarah Winman. I read that book, I fell into it and basically swam through it. It is so beautiful, and it touches on the almost mystical aspects of Cornwall and life. And I found myself by the end of it jotting down in a notebook some of her sentences and her insights because it was so beautiful, and I want to reread that book again.
So here she was, old now, standing by the roadside waiting. Ever since she had entered her 90th year, Marvelous Ways spent a good part of her day waiting. And not for death, as you might assume, given her age. She wasn't sure what she was waiting for, because the image was incomplete. It was a sense, that's all. Something that had come to her on the tail feather of a dream, one of Paper Jack's dreams, God rest his soul, and it had flown over the landscape of sleep just before light, and she hadn't been able to grasp that tail feather and pull it back before it disappeared over the horizon and disintegrated in the heat of a rising sun. But she had known its message. Wait for its coming.
Sarah Winman narrating her novel, A Year of Marvellous Ways, which is available in audio in the RNIB library. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Absolutely. The Book of Love by Fionnuala Kearney, which came out in paperback this year, so I'm assuming it's available in the library. And I just found it the most honest look into the whole of a marriage. It was unflinching in the whole thing, and it was just so beautiful. And you know, you saw bits of your own relationships there. I just felt everybody should read it.
She smiled, looked at the time, and closed the manila file she was working on. The rest could wait. There were packing boxes to be made. She had filled three with summer clothes. Trying to eat a sandwich and assemble another cardboard crate, she sang along to the Sugar Babes' Push the Button on the radio as she opened the drawer of her dressing table. Green beads, red beads, cheap beads, some expensive pearls of her mother's. She pulled them all onto her lap and began to unravel them. As she did, she allowed herself to think of their house. The house, all being well, that they'd move into in another 6 weeks. Two streets away, it was a modest semi, built in the 60s, totally charmless. But it had space and potential, and they needed space and potential more than period features. It was another stepping stone to what Dom called their final home, whenever and wherever that might be.
The Book of Love by Fionnuala Kearney is TB703938, narrated by Josie Dunlop and Oliver Hembra. And to hear Fionnuala Kearney discussing the book in a previous episode of Read On, why not go to our website and download the podcast? Well, Liz Fenwick, thank you so much for coming onto the show and sharing your genuine love of reading with the Read On listeners.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.